Welcome to the Back in Time podcast with Kyle and JD, where every week we jump into our DeLorean, hit 88 miles per hour, and travel back in time to review our favorite films. This week we travel back to June 11th, 1993 to review the box office smash hit Jurassic Park. Please remember to follow us on social media at Back in Time Pod on Twitter, Instagram, and on Facebook, Back in Time Podcast. Now, on to the show.
You're dead. You crazy son of a bitch, you're dead.
Well, we clocked the T-Rex to 32 miles an hour.
T-Rex?
Mm-hmm.
You said you've got a T-Rex?
Uh-huh. Say again.
We have a T-Rex.
Well.
Put your
Dr. Grant. My dear Dr. Sack. Welcome to Jurassic Park.
Welcome to the Back in Time podcast. I am one of the hosts, Kyle Autry, joined by my friend Justin DeSandro. Justin, how you doing, bud?
I'm doing pretty good. Glad to be on this podcast with you.
Awesome, man. Well, I'm excited that we get a chance to do this, and kind of came together pretty quick. So,
I'll say I'm a little nervous.
Yeah.
Your voice for the intro is pretty stellar, and I don't think I've got a voice for radio, so I'll be the annoying one.
There you go. So if I refer to you as JD, that is Justin for those people that do not know. And so we've known each other for a long time now. So going back to 2004.
It's marking 13 years.
Yeah.
So long.
Yeah.
Are we allowed to swear? Do we swear? No swearing?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
Absolutely no swearing or absolutely
fucking
swearing?
Yeah, we can.
Swearing?
Let them fly.
Okay. I will remember that. So yeah, it's been a long fucking time.
Yeah. So both football players, but movie geeks at heart. So that was our tie-in, our love for Dude, Where's My Car? Zoltan.
Zoltan.
There you go.
The Bubble Boys.
So yeah, so you know, my idea for the podcast was to kind of, you know, a little play on words with Back in Time, obviously from Back to the Future. And just go back and review some of our favorite movies. So I know you love Jurassic Park. I love Jurassic Park. Thought we'd start with that first.
Yeah, I think most people in the world do love Jurassic Park. Not sure what the foreign numbers were for it, but in America, at least it made everyone's childhood.
Yeah, I think you'll be surprised. I've got some pretty stellar numbers with
international
box office numbers. Pretty amazing.
I want to know the Chinese box office, too. And India. I want the, can we have like a little secret character that pops out for Kustav Sinha?
I think he should definitely make an appearance.
I agree. We need to, for those of you that don't know, Kustav Sinha is a very prominent, well-to-do Indian filmmaker.
And his specialty is?
Begging for money?
Matt painting?
Matt Damon painting?
Yeah. Has a strange love for Hilary Duff and did not know that Chris Benoit was dead as of 12 months ago.
It's a difficult time.
Really strange. Now, did you get a chance to watch the new It trailer? Because I'm pumped about that film. I know that comes out in about a month.
Ooh, I saw the one that came out for Comic-Con, and then I saw one that played on the television.
Mm-hmm.
Is that the new one? Because it looked slightly different.
Yeah, I think it is. The new one where they have the kid in the water and he's yelling. But yeah, no, I think that one's going to be really good. It looks like they put some money into it, which I was worried about them just going cheap or getting a director that's not very well known. But this looks really, really well done.
Are you worried about it at all?
No. No.
Jeez, that's confidence.
I'm super excited about this one. I think it's going to do really, really well, which a lot of horror films do. Low budgets, high money at the box office. So I think this is going to be one that performs really well.
I say my big thing about it is it looks cool. It looks like it takes a lot out of a lot of Japanese horror movies, a lot of Blumhouse horror movies where it's got a lot of the jump scares. I'm not crazy about the way Pennywise looks.
Yeah.
But if from what I heard is that they do a second movie that focuses on the adults.
Okay.
Which that's what they're saying they're going to do, because the original one had the kids part and the adults part, and this is just the kids. So if they come back and do the adults part, then I think I'll be really excited about it as a whole.
Yeah, from my understanding too, they're really sticking to the book, and it's not always going to be his voice. He can actually transform into other people, which is what kind of lures the kids in. You'll actually notice in the trailer his eyes change colors. When the kid looks down in the sewer hole, they're yellow at first, and the second glimpse they turn into blue, like his mom's eyes.
It's interesting. Really cool. I definitely didn't pick up on that.
Yeah, so there's some nice little tidbits in there, but that looks really good. I have not watched the new trailer yet for Texas Chainsaw Massacre. That one just came out, I think, yesterday on IMDb.
Yeah, I did not watch that either. I saw that it came out. I saw a still image for it, and then I remembered the last ones that came out for Texas Chainsaw Massacre, and then was not interested in watching the trailer.
Right. Because they've redone this how many times now? Three?
This has got to be like the third or the fourth reboot.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe need some more time to pass before they jump into that. But cool. So that's kind of what's going on in movie trailers, I guess, but... So let's dive into some Jurassic Park. So we go to 1993. I'm 8 years old at that point. How old are you in June of 93?
Also eight. Yeah. Would have turned eight in March of that year.
Yeah. So is this a movie that you're seeing in theaters, or is this something we wait for VHS to come around?
I know that we saw it in theaters. I remember going with my older brother and then two of our neighbors. And I remember the neighbor's mom drove us there, and she had a Jeep at the time, so it was super exciting.
Right.
So we drove to Jurassic Park in a gas-powered Jeep. And I can honestly say I don't remember much about the movie itself when I was a kid, other than going bullshit over all the dinosaurs.
Right. Yeah, I think that's definitely for eight-year-olds, that's the main focus for sure. Or the T-Rex, and there is so much. I actually have a whole page of stuff we'll cover here as far as what they released in toys, and there's a giant McDonald's deal where they had the cups and all that stuff. We can definitely get into that. So this movie, doing some research on it, found out that Spielberg acquires this in 1990 with the help from Universal Studios for $1.5 million. And actually outbid Rob Reiner and Joe Dante from Gremlins, were guys trying to get their hands on this novel. On top of the $1.5 million, they have to pay Michael Crichton an extra $500,000 to adapt his own novel into a screenplay.
So he adapted it.
Yep. He's one of the two writers, and then they bring in a third writer that touches it up toward the end. So he walks away with about $2 million for a novel that went on to sell a lot of copies.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's already, the novel itself was successful.
Right, right. So yeah, very, very well received, and definitely a New York Times bestseller for sure. So this one's produced by Kathleen Kennedy. So anybody that doesn't know Kathleen Kennedy, she's now in charge of the Star Wars franchise, did the Back to the Future movies. So she's very, very good at the producing role. So they spend 25 months in pre-production for this movie before it starts filming in August of 92. And they film through November. Post-production would go up until May of 93. And Spielberg oversees everything. At the same time, he's filming a little-known movie called Schindler's List.
No big deal.
No big deal. They won a few Academy Awards with that one. So, thoughts on obviously Steven Spielberg getting his hands on the movie, and could have went to a couple other guys that are pretty good directors, but what are your thoughts about that?
Well, I really still can't get over the fact that you said Joe Dante was trying to get his hands on this, and I'm trying to imagine what this looks like coming from him.
Right.
And he's still working hard. He's a pretty prolific director, right, and, you know, filmmaker, but as a kid, you know, you knew the name Steven Spielberg. There was the episode of The Simpsons where Montgomery Burns goes to Steven Spielberg's Spanish counterpart, Esteban Spielbergo. So you know the name, but like looking back at what Steven Spielberg's done and seeing his movies and being like, okay, he did Schindler's List and Jurassic Park. He did an adult movie, a kid movie. I mean, he's got so many things that he's done that like I've enjoyed, from Catch Me If You Can, you know, not War of the Worlds, but I mean,
He's had a couple stinkers in there, but for the most part, I mean, he's pretty much bad in 400. He's an all-time great for sure.
Yeah.
So now the score for the movie is done by the great John Williams, and he had actually worked with Spielberg previously on the film Close Encounters of the Third Kind. Were you a big fan of Close Encounters? I love that movie.
I know I saw it when I was a kid, and I don't think I've seen it since, so it's definitely one that we should add to the list to review.
There you go. Absolutely. So Williams obviously is best known for doing the score for Star Wars. He's had 74 films and has brought in over $22 billion at the box office from movies that he scored. So I thought that was pretty interesting. It's actually quite a bit more than Spielberg has. He's got him beat by about $10 billion in box office money. Granted, most of that's from Star Wars. Now, the movie starts, or actually when it wraps, they report the budget for the movie, $63 million, which is pretty modest, I would say, for a movie of this size. What do you think?
Geez, by today's standards, it's nothing.
Right. I mean, they spent way more than that on the Ghostbusters reboot.
Gosh.
Let's not get started on that one.
How much did they spend on that? Do you know?
I think they hit $90 million. That was one of the big issues I know Dan Aykroyd had with it, was they were terribly over budget. So the one thing I thought was really interesting is, so the budget for the movie is $63 million. They spend $65 million additional in marketing for the movie, bringing it up to about $128 million in total, which is a pretty big investment in 1993, albeit it's done by Universal, who has a lot of money, but obviously they're counting on this movie being a pretty massive hit.
Yeah, and I think that the marketing that they did do with the amount of fast food promotions and action figures and the dinosaurs that had the little bit of skin that come off of their butt, they made it into a freaking a kid's dream through their marketing and promotions, where, you know, even some reviewers, you know, talked about how the movie focused too much on the dinosaurs, but the key takeaway from it, especially in 1993 for, you know, people of your age, my age, our generation, was the dinosaurs.
Right.
And it brought it to life in the movie, but also in America.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And we'll get into some of the reviews, because I know you found a couple really good ones. Apparently not everybody thought it was the greatest movie of all time. So Jurassic Park is released to 2,404 screens domestically in June 11th of 93. First 3 days, they gross $50 million, making it the number one movie at the box office. Not a bad start. Almost recouped their entire budget for the movie just in the first 3 days.
That's impressive.
Yep. It goes on to spend another 2 weeks at the top of the box office. Second week, bringing in $38 million. Third week, $27 million before finally getting upset and falling to the second spot. So, crazy tidbit here, something you would never see today. Jurassic Park was in theaters for 486 days.
Consecutively.
Last weekend being October 10th of 94. Domestic gross ends at $395 million.
Domestic, that is impressive. Do you know what movie is the one that beat it out for that top spot?
That's a great question. I was going to look that up, and I have not. So as we're talking, I'll try and find it here.
I was going to say, I bet one of us can try to look it up really quick.
Absolutely. I think you go to, I went to boxofficemojo.com. That's where I found a lot of the numbers. So while you're talking there, so 486 days, when's the last time we heard of a movie staying in theaters past maybe 3 months? Much less an entire calendar year plus another 4 months.
Yeah, you're lucky to be able to catch a movie that comes out. If you don't see it that first month, you're kind of shit out of luck.
Yeah. Now, internationally, I know we talked about this earlier, wondering how it did overseas. So it goes on to bring in an additional $643 million in international box office money, bringing the worldwide total, this $1,038,812,000. So at that point, this is the first and only film at Universal to cross the $1 billion. So,
and on a side note, the movie that beat Jurassic Park was The Firm.
The Firm, nice. Who stars in that one? I'm picturing the DVD cover right now.
It's either Tom Cruise or Tom Hanks. They were pretty interchangeable in 93. I mean that with the utmost respect to Tom Hanks.
Right. Now, the movie goes out of theaters October of 94. So knowing how much success they had, how quick do you think they are to get this thing to VHS? Because it's a different time back then. It's not like it is today.
I know it was a while because I remember the first time I watched it on VHS.
Mm-hmm.
And I was living in a new house. So.
Yep. So we're looking at the movie leaves theaters on October 10th. 6 days earlier, it's finally released on VHS, almost 14 months after the release.
Crazy. It's a long time.
Now, at that point, obviously, Blockbuster is massive. You've got box office video. I don't think Hollywood Video is quite there yet. So this is released on VHS and Laserdisc. And they move 17 million units in both formats. So I know when we talked the other night, you said you owned it on both Laserdisc and VHS. Is that right?
Yes, and DVD and Blu-ray.
Yeah. So I think I've got VHS, DVD, and I bought the Blu-ray when Jurassic World came out because Best Buy ran a special where you got a free movie ticket if you bought the Blu-ray.
Of course.
So it was a wash. Now the movie goes on to become the fifth highest selling VHS tape of all time. Justin, without the power of the internet, any idea what the number one VHS tape of all time is?
Cocoon.
Not even close.
Oh, damn it.
And it is not a live action or comedy movie. It's an animation movie.
Is it one of those animated Japanese pornos?
It's close. The Lion King.
Ow. My serious guess would have been Aladdin.
Yeah. Aladdin's got to be up there. I couldn't find a list of top-selling VHS, but for some reason, they rank this one as fifth, and Lion King sold 50 million VHS tapes. So that's a lot of VHS tapes laying around there on eBay, I'm sure.
For a buck a pop.
Right. Right. So overall, now that the movie's been out of theaters for 24 years, this now ranks as the 27th best domestic box office hit of all time. In 1993, it was number one, so it's obviously been passed up by quite a few. It's the only other 1990 film in the top 30 outside of Titanic and Star Wars Episode I, The Phantom Menace. So that's kind of all the stats that I pulled up. Now, let's get into the reviews before we actually kind of dive into the movie. So how's this movie received by critics and what you could find?
Well, let me first say that I accidentally clicked out of the window that had that open. So give me a second. Where'd you go? So In terms of reviews, it did extraordinarily well, at least according to Rotten Tomato. It has it at 93% fresh, which means that, you know, 93% of the people that register reviews through Rotten Tomato like it.
Yeah.
I don't know that Rotten Tomato actually has a really secure methodology for its reviews, other than I think people really just like saying things are fresh or rotten.
Right.
But it does list the average rating as an 8.3 out of 10, counting off of 117 reviews, 109 of those being fresh, 8 being rotten. So the thing that I like about Rotten Tomatoes is it does take from a professional, and then it does take from some amateur.
Yeah.
So it's not all Roger Ebert who, you know, gave it 3 out of 4 stars.
That's pretty good. He was not an easy critic. So 3 out of 4 from him is pretty big in 93.
See, I thought I remembered him not liking the movie, but I can't remember what movie it was then that he didn't like.
In that day, I mean, if he didn't like a movie, that pretty much crushed it at the box office. This guy is like the IMDb of his day, or Rotten Tomatoes. Everybody read the paper to read his reviews.
True. So, but yeah, so, I mean, overall, it's definitely got quality reviews. If again, like you said, Roger Ebert likes it. That means the rest of the world likes it. Every child likes it. If there's anybody listening that did not like this movie as a child, please let us know.
Right. You can get us on social media, Back in Time Pod, and we'll tweet you back and tell you how much of a moron you are.
Yeah, I think either of us are very happy to argue the finer points of Jurassic Park with anyone in the world. Really, there are some pretty solid negative reviews, which in all honesty isn't surprising. Right. You know, looking back at it or rewatching it as an adult versus a kid, you definitely are way more skeptical.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, reading some of these reviews of, and I don't know that we should name the person because I've never heard of any of them.
Right.
The New Yorker had this to say about the movie. For all the ingenuity of the movie's engineering, Jurassic Park doesn't have the imagination or the courage to take us any place we haven't been 1,000 times before. It's just a creature feature on amphetamines.
Interesting. Interesting.
I mean, it's the New Yorker, so obviously they're going to use a bunch of fancy $5 words.
Right. Right. Yeah, no, I couldn't disagree more. I think this movie's cutting edge with the way that they portray the dinosaurs and the animatronics and all that stuff. But that's interesting to hear. They feel like it didn't take it anywhere new.
Right. And then even, you know, this some asshat, I don't even know, I can't even pronounce the name of this guy's website, but he's complaining that the problem with the film, plain and simple, is that it focuses all of its energies on the dinosaurs themselves.
He's mad that it's not more character development and that they went to a giant amusement park about dinosaurs and had a lot of dinosaurs.
Well, I wonder if maybe he saw a version of the movie that was just the trailer.
Right.
And didn't actually see the movie. Because one, why would you complain that the dinosaur movie is about dinosaurs?
That doesn't make any sense.
Two, like, do not remember Dr. Alan Grant? Do not remember Dr. Ellie Sattler? Do not remember the kids? Do not remember Jeff Goldblum? I mean, what in the world have you been watching other than this, like, amazing character arc of where we learn about all of freaking Jeff Goldblum's ex-wives, and then he's hitting on Ellie Sattler and Dr. Grant. They've got this, like, unspoken relationship, and it's like,
right. The
guy's an idiot.
Yeah, and once we get into the review here, Jeff Goldblum's character in this movie is kind of a scene stealer for me. I feel like he has most of the best lines. And he has such a dry humor, which is why I think I really like him in most movies he's in.
Oh, yeah. He delivers so softly and so gracefully that it's both creepy and unsettling and interesting.
Right.
You don't know whether to be scared or laugh sometimes.
Yeah, I think probably my favorite line of the movie from him is where Dr. Sattler wants to look at the dino droppings, and they go to him and he just goes, the dino droppings?
Yeah. Oh my god.
Don't forget to wash your hands later before you eat.
And of course, I mean, and so this reviewer is complaining about the dinosaurs, and there's literally a big pile of dinosaur shit.
Right.
Like, they don't hold anything back. Like, comparatively, if you want to talk about, let's talk about Westworld. You know, I know that they get into a little bit of like the animatronic STDs that go on, but we don't get to see all of the green goop coming out of them and all the sexually transmitted diseases going to humans.
Right.
Jurassic Park, you get to see a gigantic pile of dinosaur shit.
Yeah. A big pile of crap, for sure. Now, were there any positive reviews other than Roger Ebert? Anything else that you found on there that was good?
Oh, yeah. I mean, again, with 93% people calling it the greatest cinematic thrill ride of all time, cautionary tale about scientists, people call it tasteful. They're enjoying both the direction, the acting, the graphics, the dinosaurs. I mean, it's a masterpiece of a movie for 1993.
Right. Yep. No, I couldn't agree more. So let's get into a little bit of the casting of the movie. So we got some pretty good actors in this movie. Not, I don't know that they're necessarily giant stars, especially at that point in their career, but especially Samuel L. Jackson, who's kind of a background guy for the most part with a couple lines, which is interesting. But let's start with Dr. Grant and kind of work our way down. So thoughts on Sam Neill being cast as Dr. Grant?
Well, I'm going to come at it from the perspective of when I was a kid, and Dr. Grant was just this very stern, angry old man. Like, I did not like him as a kid.
Right.
And when he was on the screen, I was very uncomfortable. I did not want to see any Dr. Grant. He's just, you know, he's everybody's dad that you just don't like. He's just grumpy. Just somebody get him a tamale.
Absolutely. So I read that a couple people turned down the role for Dr. Grant, one of them being it was offered to Harrison Ford, obviously had the Spielberg connection. And Sam Neill gets cast about 3 weeks before production, so he has no time to read the book and is on set taking orders from Spielberg about as fast as he said yes. You got Dr. Ellie Sattler. She's a paleobotanist and Grant's girlfriend. That's being played by Laura Dern. Thoughts on Laura Dern? And I've actually enjoyed her work for a lot of years, and she's still very active.
So what I'll say about Laura Dern and Dr. Ellie Sattler is a little weird, so bear with me. But I think I sort of reached sexual maturity at the part where she's eating the ice cream in the cafeteria, and she takes the spoon and she turns it backwards and she licks it, and she goes, good. And I was just like, holy shit. What just happened to me?
Right.
And looking back at it, I don't find her attractive now, but when I was a child, apparently I did.
That's interesting.
Yeah, it's a weird story.
So where do we go from there? So let's jump into Jeff Goldblum, who I know is one of your favorites. And you actually got a chance to meet him, which I'm sure you can share that story, but let's talk about Jeff Goldblum, who beat out Jim Carrey for the role of being able to play the mathematician.
Yeah, chaotician.
Yeah, exactly. Which he corrects.
So the thing that I love about, you know, taking a movie and going back in time and reviewing it is that it gives you a chance to sort of like revisit your thoughts of them as a kid. And he was so cool. You know, he was dressed in black. He had the tinted glasses. He's flirting with Laura Dern. Anybody tells him anything, and he's slamming his fist, and he's telling them that they're wrong. Like, he was a rock star in that. And I really even think John Hammond describes him as a rock star at one point.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, he's up until that point. I'm trying to think of, you know, he's probably, when I was a kid, I recognized who he was in that role. Like, I was like, okay, I know who that guy is. I mean, it was before Independence Day. And you know, by the time Independence Day came in, everybody knew, like, oh, that's Dr. Ian Malcolm. But my gosh, I mean, he's such a complex actor, and he portrays such an amazing character. And, you know, like you mentioned, I did have a chance to meet him. He puts on some jazz shows in L.A. He's got his own little quartet going on. And then he rubs elbows with the crowds afterwards. And, you know, I spent a few minutes talking to him, and he's one of the nicest guys in the world.
That's awesome. And it's, now, what's his jazz band called? Is it just Jeff Goldblum Jazz Band? Or
I know he sings. Jeff Goldblum and the Mildred Snitzer Orchestra.
Love it. Good name. So, yeah. Great. So, Dr. Ian Malcolm, mathematician and chaos theorist. So, yeah, he's got a great role in the movie. Like I said, I think he has all the best one-liners. So we move into the CEO of InGen, an architect of Jurassic Park, and that's John Hammond, played by the great Richard Attenborough. So he's not, at this point, I think for a lot of kids, as an eight-year-old, we probably have no idea who he is. Obviously, he's one of the all-time greats, but what did you think of his performance as John Hammond?
Oh, he is fantastic. He brings so much energy and so much creepiness. He always reminded me of Scrooge McDuck, especially in the first scene when they're in the trailer out in Montana, and he's popping open the champagne, and he's like, "Oh, saving for a day like today." I was like, I think Scrooge McDuck says that in DuckTales.
Right.
But, I mean, his character is so tragic in that, you know, he's got a dream. Starts with the flea circus, you know, despite whatever Ellie Sattler tries to poop on his dream about the flea circus for.
Yeah.
And he creates this world, this, you know, it's a park, but it's a world where the impossible is possible. And is such a jovial and energetic actor that you can see, like, he's so in love what he's done, and to see it go to shit.
Yeah.
Sort of breaks his heart.
Yeah, actually, one of the last scenes, they show his face in the helicopter, and you can see it in his face, just absolute destroyed that yeah. park did not work. And the cool thing is he spares absolutely no expense.
None.
Throughout the whole movie. And that role was almost offered to John Connery, who actually I could totally see in that role with his voice. He actually had a close relationship with the writer Michael Crichton, but wanted more money than Universal was willing to pony up. So that's why the role goes to somebody else, and we get Sir Richard Attenborough to take it.
It would have been quite great to have Sean Connery in the role, but Richard Attenborough did such a great job. No expense, dumb.
Now, we've got the two kids. Let's talk about them. Why don't you want to talk about the kids?
Timmy was so annoying. And the girl, I can't even remember the girl's name.
All right, so we got Timothy Tim Murphy, who's Lex's younger brother, loves dinosaurs and has read every Dr. Grant book. He apparently got the role because Spielberg wanted to cast him in Hook, but he was too little and too young for Hook. So he promised him he would put him in his next project. And he wasn't right for Schindler's List, so this one made sense.
Well, it's just interesting that he would have gone from casting, you know, he wanted to cast Timmy in Hook, but instead he did Robin Williams. I mean, that's just such a big age difference there.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, totally.
And he's still acting. He's not in anything big, but I know he was in The Social Network, which did pretty well.
Was he really?
Yeah, he's one of the college kids.
Huh. Did not realize that.
Yep, and he went to, I forget which school he went to on L.A. And studied film there. And his role in the sequel, which lasts about 60 seconds, paid for his entire college tuition.
That is the way to do it.
He calls it Spielberg's graduation present. So Lex, that's the older sister, Hammond's granddaughter. She's a vegetarian and self-professed computer hacker, and goes by Lex. And that's Ariana Richards, who was in Tremors, which is a classic. We may have to put that on the list. She beats out one of my favorite childhood actors from that point, Christina Ricci, from the Addams Family. And I guess her distinctive look and the fact that she had just done Addams Family is what deterred Universal and Spielberg from casting her as the younger star.
I am definitely, you know, I was not a fan of Lex in the movie. She was always screaming and running around and getting sneezed on and just being awful.
Right.
But while I also love Christina Ricci, I don't think she would have been right for the role at all.
No. No, and I know from watching some of the special features on the Blu-ray, Ariana gets the role because they bring her in and have her scream, and that's apparently what she was really good at. So that scream is what lands her the role.
And I think that scream is what most people remember about her in that movie, with the head cocked to the side and the...
For sure. So we move into some of the secondary cast. We won't cover everybody, but we definitely have to talk about Samuel L. Jackson.
Oh, Mr. Arnold.
Yeah, Mr. Arnold, the park's chief engineer. He switches off the main power to reboot the mainframe. In the meantime, frying poor Timmy like a piece of toast. and unwittingly unleashes the raptors when he does that. So he ultimately comes to demise by the hands of a velociraptor.
So you're saying he's the villain of the movie?
He may be the guy that's behind this whole thing, and I think he's the bad guy, and rightfully so. He gets eaten. So
that's true.
No screaming from Samuel L. Jackson in this movie. I found that odd.
Well, he screams at the computer at one point when, you know, he's trying to get in with the password, and then Newman's screensaver, you didn't say the magic word. Right. Oh, please, damn it!
You're
the,
right.
The cigarette does, dangling off of
he
his
does
lips,
scream so. At that part. I definitely missed that. Yeah, funny, Newman isn't too far away cast from this character, which is Nedry. so they didn't steer too far from the boat on that one. But I don't know that we'll talk about Samuel L. Jackson again anytime soon. I'm trying to think of any movies he did in the 90s, but obviously he's had a hell of a career. Probably out of all the people on this list, he's by far the biggest star. And he's a secondary character in this one.
He really is. And you talk to a lot of people, I think a lot of people sort of forget he's in it.
Right.
And which is too bad, because he's almost has a full head of hair.
Right. Yep.
And he's plays a smart guy. What did you say he was? He was the chief something or another?
Park chief engineer.
Park chief engineer. Like, to be the park chief engineer in 1993 at Jurassic Park, I mean, the character had to have been making a lot of money.
Yeah, yep. And I think one of the interesting things about his character is, again, he's got a couple nice little one-liners in there. I enjoy this cigarette in his mouth at all seconds. I don't think he ever even puts it out at any point. But I'm a big fan of the hold on to your butts. And he says it twice in the movie, which is awesome. Now, let's talk about Newman, a.k.a. Dennis Nedry, played by Wayne Knight, disgruntled architect of Jurassic Park's computer system. He is bribed by Biosyn agent Lewis Dodson.
Dodson. We got Dodson here.
For $1.5 million to deliver frozen dinosaur embryos. And he's also, he's eventually killed by a Dilophosaurus. Which, interesting enough, is the first dinosaur that they see when they enter the park and can't find. I thought that was cool foreshadowing.
I never picked up on that. Well done to you. Tip of the cap, sir.
There we go. So let's talk about Wayne Knight. I think that's a pretty good casting call on that one. He kind of plays that character perfectly. Best known as Newman. I was not a big Seinfeld guy, but maybe you can talk on that a little bit.
Well, I first want to cut back and say, if there's any chance that we can show a picture or share a picture of what Nedry's action figure looked like.
Oh my gosh.
I think that I think our listeners really need to take a moment to look at, to compare a picture of what Dennis Nedry looked like and then what the action figure looked like. Mick, he looked like Hulk Hogan in the action figure. He's just this ripped, buffed guy with this like wonderful set of hair and sunglasses, and he's got a gun, and I'm already
getting on eBay trying to figure out where I can buy that action figure.
But I mean, he's nothing like Newman. I mean, you said you're not a Seinfeld fan. I was always a Seinfeld fan, and so
yeah.
You know, being able to recognize Newman from Seinfeld and then to see him in Jurassic Park is a bumbling idiot. You know, he's not the mailman. He's this bumbling computer tech. And then he goes on to be in Third Rock from the Sun as a bumbling cop.
Yeah. And you know, one of the things with his character too is he's not, he's also a little conniving too, because he's in the background, he's got his Barbasol can of shaving cream filled up with these embryos. He's trying to go through a monsoon, which just looks like they open up a fire hydrant on set. I think the rain might have been a little overdone on that part. Eventually he meets the Dilophosaurus and gets sprayed in his eyes and eaten to death in the SUV.
So, and he loses his glasses along the way.
Yeah, he lost his glasses, so he couldn't see very well. I wonder, I haven't gone back to watch the second or third movie, do they ever find the can of Barbasol? Because that's got the embryos pretty much secured in there, because it's a coolant that they put inside of that thing.
That's a really good question. And I do think, if you remember, they came out with, I think it's Telltale Games, came out with sort of like that, not point and click, but it was like a story-driven game, came out on the Xbox 360. And I think that game revolves around them either looking for the canister or finding the canister. But the canister, they come up with something to bring it back. But in the other movies, I don't think it ever comes up, or his lost glasses.
Yep, absolutely.
And just totally on topic but off topic, the reason why I personally wear contacts and don't wear glasses is in case I'm ever chased by a dinosaur, I don't want to have my glasses fall off and then be unable to see where I'm being attacked from. So I always wear contacts.
It's safe to say Dennis Nedry has saved your life.
Yeah. Oh, totally.
Without a doubt. Because you could be eaten at any minute by a, by a Dilophosaurus. You never know when those things are going to pop up and go and spray you in the face.
That was good.
That was a pretty good impression, right?
That was really good. I was gonna make the joke how they should do a 1-800 contacts commercial about Dennis Nedry getting attacked, and then he's like, good thing I went to 1-800 contacts, and then he drives off and he's okay.
Right. Now, what part of the toys that they end up releasing happen to be eye disguise, one-way vision lenses that you can see out of but others can't see in. One has a T-Rex on the side and it's yellow. The other one has the Jurassic Park logo. And that's one of the toys that they end up putting out, interesting enough, is a pair of glasses. I feel like they missed the boat on maybe some like yellow contact lenses, Jurassic Park style.
Or if they made like Dilophosaurus muck glasses that you can wear on your face.
Right.
Like when he gets sprayed and he can't see, but you know, maybe they make it so you can't see, so everybody thinks you did get attacked by a Dilophosaurus.
That would have been cool too. So, I mean, that's pretty much it. I didn't have a lot to add on that one. Talk about the blood-sucking lawyer if we wanted to. Ferrero is who plays that.
He has two of the biggest parts because he's wearing the suit but with the shorts when they're in that mine in, I'm just going to make up a country that's not America, when they're in Peru. in the beginning, and he slips and he almost falls into the water and he almost dies.
Yeah.
But then he gets fucking eaten on the toilet.
Interesting enough, he doesn't appear to be taking a crap because he's still fully clothed. So I don't know exactly what he was doing on the pot there.
In my mind, his pants are around his legs.
Yeah, I remember the long socks, but I'm remembering the pants being up, and that also could be because we're 8-year-olds and we don't really need to see that.
He's still naked in my mind.
Yes, okay. I love the character names. So for him especially, I think they might have thrown this in at the last minute because the actor's real name is Martin Ferrero, but they cast him as Donald Gennaro. So I think that might have been either a running gag or a last minute, we don't have a name for this guy, let's just rhyme it with his real name.
Well, it's like a generic Ferrero.
Right.
Gennaro.
So that's pretty much it on the cast. I don't think we're missing any big players. You got B.D. Wong, who comes back up in Jurassic World, who's the chief geneticist that designs the dinosaurs there, but nobody else of too much. I'm forgetting one. We're forgetting the park warden, Bob.
Oh, Heck. Muldoon.
So he is concerned by the intelligence of the raptors, which later Chris Pratt is as well, apparently, and would like to have them all destroyed. He eventually is offed and killed by a velociraptor.
Well, they spring a trap on him.
Right.
Clever. Which I think it's definitely foreshadowing that, you know, Jurassic World, where Chris Pratt is trying to teach them tricks and things and stuff. And so, you know, he's such a cool, he's so badass, and he's got his guns and he's got his shorts and his high socks, yeah, and his hat and his vest. And then he's got one of the coolest lines ever before he dies. Clever girl.
Clever girl. Yeah, so he unfortunately passes away at 53 years old. Not a lot of big movies on his resume, but I thought he did an awesome job in that role.
There's one more name that I'm going to throw in that we talk about if we still have time.
Yeah, do it.
So the part of Dotson.
Dotson. Absolutely.
Played by a man whose name is Cameron Thor.
Mm-hmm.
Who's currently in prison for sexual misconduct.
Ooh, uh-oh.
He was sentenced to 6 years in prison for lewd conduct with a 13-year-old female student.
Yeah, I'm seeing that on his IMDb. That's pretty recent, too.
Yeah, it was definitely recent. I mean, when you're Dotson, you think nobody cares. You think nobody's paying attention. You think you can just sexually, lewdly misconduct a 13-year-old. But no, the police see. They see.
Right. Yeah, so I remember reading that he was cast in that role because he's also in Hook.
Is he really?
Interesting enough, yeah. But we got Dotson. Now, let's talk about the actual movie and get into the review. I know you said you saw it roughly about a year ago. I rewatched it this morning. First impressions on how you feel like the movie's held up now that it's 24 years old and how it looks cinematically.
Yeah, the most depressing part is when you say it's 24 years old.
Right.
I remember when I was 24 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And now I'm even more depressed.
So, you know, I guess my first impression is, it, like a lot of Spielberg movies, this hasn't lost a lot.
I will say the one thing that got me the last time I watched it is I think you sort of forget how long it is.
Right.
And I'm going to look that up.
2 hours for sure.
And it's sort of 2 hours and 7 minutes.
Yep.
And so, I mean, by today's standards, that's a pretty average movie.
Mm-hmm.
But back then, a 2 hour and 7 minute movie was massive.
Right.
So, yeah, you know,
especially for a group of 8 year olds.
Oh, yeah. And especially since there's portions in the middle of the movie that get into a lot of the more technical and scientific and legal aspects. There's a lot of adult conversations when they're eating dinner in that room that's got like the projector.
Right.
And it's really dark, and Ian Malcolm's complaining about branding on the silverware and the plates, and he's pounding his fist. And, you know, even now as an adult, like I kind of zone out during those parts, even though they're incredibly well acted. They're shot beautifully. They're great scenes. But yeah, to the idiot reviewer's point of, oh, it's just about dinosaurs, I mean, I'm just waiting for the action to come back.
Right. Right. Yeah, and to what you said earlier about Laura Dern, I definitely need to go back to the ice cream scene. So that will be on my to-do list today.
It sounds very creepy when you say it like that.
Well, I have to see what you're talking about with the ice. I guess I never picked up on her sexualizing her ice cream cone.
You know, I wonder if anyone else has ever noticed that about the ice cream. It's when her and John Hammond are eating in the cafeteria. I mean, hey, let us know.
If you've noticed it, hit us up on Twitter and Instagram and let us know if you've had this ice cream dream that Justin has.
The ice cream dream.
Now, kind of jumping into the movie here a little bit. So, obviously, the movie starts out pretty cool opening scene. I'm trying to get a kind of a rundown here in the back of my mind here, but I know it starts with the scene where they're transporting a Velociraptor and trying to get him into the, I think they're into a cage or maybe into a holding area.
Yeah, they're moving him from, they have him in like the transport chamber to box, and they're trying to get him into the holding chamber, which we later see them in. The one right. Muldoon is showing off the raptors when they feed him the, I believe it's a cow that they eat.
Yes, he gets lowered in and they show it eating the cow, destroying the support cables and the fabric harness in the process.
Mm.
With that, it kind of ends with that opening scene where he's...
Shoot her!
Yeah, there you go. There it is. Shoot her! Just screaming. And then we go right into the architects. And they're starting to move some sand and discover some bones.
I'm sorry, did you call them architects?
I certainly did. Yep. Paleontologist.
That's okay. That's more. Don't mean to call you out on that. It took me a moment.
That's totally fine. But take it from there. Let's talk about the paleontologist and how we get introduced to Dr. Grant and Ellie.
So I always love this scene. You know, they're in this wide open desert area, and they just got their little brushes, and they're brushing away so delicately. You know, as a kid, it makes you think like this is it. This is what I want to do with my life. I want to play in the sand and brush sand away from bones. You know.
Yeah.
And then you know we're introduced to Dr. Grant, and you know he has his problem with technology, which becomes a running theme throughout the movie. We're introduced to the fat kid who gets sliced up by the raptor claw.
Yeah, I love the chubby kid in that one.
Yeah, he was so poor kid. I wonder if like when he went to school, if people were like, "Hey, Johnny, come over here for a second," and they like would rip his shirt and they'd be like, "You're an asshole. No one likes you."
At that point, we go into the airplanes coming down, or I should say the chopper, and we get introduced to John Hammond, who is apparently been funding their expedition of discovering dinosaur bones here for a while, and now he needs some help from him.
So that's the part that I always found like story wise fascinating. And have you read the book at all?
I read it way back in I think high school. It's a long book, and they did not use a lot. I think maybe 10-20%. Of the movies actually from the book.
So that's the part that I find fun, having read the book and then having seen the movie, is like the whole big whopping story that doesn't necessarily get included. Like you're right. Saying, it's 10-20% of the book is the movie. And so like John Hammond, and here he is, I almost called him John Hamm. here he is, he's dressed in white. You know, I'm sure we can make some metaphorical conclusion that he's a Christ figure because he's bringing the dinosaurs back from the dead.
Right.
He's got his hat, and, you know, he's just so chipper and confident, and, you know, he's clean compared to how they're dirty from the sand, and, you know, his copter ruined their sight by spitting dirt everywhere, and it's just sort of like, it's almost like an intense kind of a scene where you almost feel like you don't know who he is or if you can trust him or anything like that, but he's still energetic.
Right. After that, we go to Dennis Nedry, who's meeting with Dotson, a rival scientist of InGen. Working with Bioson, Dennis is a computer programmer working for John on Isla Nublar and has recently become dissatisfied with his treatment by InGen. So we got Dotson.
We got Dotson here. And so the part that I always love about this scene is he's sitting there and he's eating all the food, Nedry. Right. And then here comes Dotson, and he makes Dotson pay for his lunch.
Right. Don't get cheap.
And then, don't get cheap on me, Dotson. And the part that I love is, one, this is the part where we get the famous Nedry squeal when he's investigating the can of Barbasol.
Right.
And it pops open, and he goes, and he squeals. And then he takes the shaving cream, he tests it out, and he puts it on top of that piece of pie next to him. Now, and it looks like whipped cream.
I thought he would eat the pie, I'm going to be honest.
Somebody eats the pie, and they're going to be very disappointed by the whipped cream shaving cream.
Yep. So after Dotson picks up the tab, We go to John arriving in the helicopter. Obviously, pretty cool scenery on this shot where they go over the ocean, I assume. And you see them kind of coming up to the island there. First thing they do is jump into a couple Jeeps. We meet the kids. And right away, I'm sure you're pretty annoyed with Timmy.
He is very annoying. I know Alan Grant is very annoyed.
Yes.
And apparently at one point, Ellie Sattler suggested to the kids that they sit with him because she says it'll be good for him.
Right.
That was kind of like a strike one bitch move for me. I was like, Ellie Sattler, really? Sit with the kids because it'll be good for him? Why is it going to be good for him?
She's checking what? Out if he's dad material.
See, I don't buy that.
Yeah.
I don't think that an adult should ever be alone in a car with two kids that aren't his own.
That's a good point.
What happened to Cameron Thor.
Right.
He did not learn that lesson.
Yeah, Dotson should have paid attention on that scene.
And it's a really good thing that Ellie Sattler didn't tell the kids to go hang out with Dotson.
So they eventually jump into the Jeep, and they start heading out to the park, and we come across a herd of hadrosaurs, if I'm saying that right. And basically everybody's pretty much in amazement. You got a Brachiosaurus, and they end up eventually going into the visitor center. But this, I guess, probably the best line of the movie, or maybe the most memorable, is John Hammond here. So do you remember the line?
I'm wondering if you're getting it when he says, "Welcome to Jurassic Park."
There we go. Yep.
Or when he goes, "We have a T-Rex." Did you say T-Rex? We have a T-Rex.
Yes. Yep, so we get to see the first glimpse of the dinosaurs. Obviously, they look really cool. I know doing some research, I saw that the T-Rex was 20 feet tall, the one they built, and was like 15,000 pounds. So, I mean, this thing, they probably don't have to put in too much sound effect for him running on the ground, because that's a big boy there. So we go into the visitor center. And we're going to get to witness a birth of an infant Velociraptor. And this is a pretty cool scene where they're showing you how they recreate dinosaurs using DNA from mosquitoes, which, interesting enough, is really how Spielberg becomes interested in this project. Is he was working with Crichton on another one, and he explained he was working on a book about dinosaurs that would take DNA from mosquitoes. Let's talk about the birth of the Velociraptors.
So I think that scene in particular is really cool because it gives a good behind the scenes of Jurassic Park. You know, we see the doctors, we get introduced to BD Wong, we see the technology with the claw thing that turns the eggs.
Right.
You know, I always thought that scene was so cool. Like, I wanted to be in that laboratory so bad.
Oh, definitely.
And the way that the raptor cracks through the eggshell, I always thought, like, man, that eggshell seems really thin.
Yep.
But I guess we just don't know how strong baby raptors are.
Yeah, tough to say. Look at 65 million years ago.
Right.
So now we, after that, they end up going into, they start to, I guess, before I skip past that, Grant and Ellie as well, I mean, their kind of initial shock has worn off, and they start to express some concerns and repercussions here of what might happen with these dinosaurs. So after they leave the birth, they end up meeting up with
Muldoon. I think there's a restaurant called Muldoon's.
Right. So, and he kind of explains there are only three raptors together, because the big one, which is the alpha female, has killed all but two of them, and they originally had eight raptors. So, and then meanwhile, we get to see the cow getting lowered into the dinosaur enclosure and observe it getting eaten, or observe it eating the cow, destroying all the cables and fabric and all that stuff.
So my question is, when Alan Grant is explaining how raptors attacked to the chubby kid earlier,
right,
and he says he takes the raptor takes the claw and he slices across your belly, you know, spilling your guts.
Right.
And then he's like, you know, that's, you know, you're dying, but you're not dead. And that's when the raptor starts to eat you.
Right.
Do you think that's what the raptor does to the cow too? Or do you think it just eats the cow?
Oh, no, I think for sure it just right across the old belly. And then they just go to town on that bad boy. For sure.
Nice.
So
I think that this scene in particular is really cool because they don't show what's happening to the dinosaur. I guess is the point that I'm getting at. Right. I'm sorry, they don't show what's happening to the cow.
Exactly. Yeah, you just see like a bunch of raptors kind of jumping into one spot, and you see the cables and everything kind of flying up. They're just destroying. All you see is a harness getting destroyed, basically.
Right, and it's. I think it's cool because it definitely does. You know, you don't see the dinosaurs, you don't see what they're doing, you don't see what they're killing,
right?
But you know what's going on, and you hear the noises, and you hear them getting eating and devouring and running about all over the place, and it creates this like epic bad guy, and it's in the same way that Steven Spielberg does with the shark in Jaws, where you go so long without actually seeing the shark.
Yeah.
But you know it's a threat.
Exactly. Yeah, that's a really good comparison. So after that experiment of watching the cow get just destroyed, they go on the lunch. Alan, Ian, Ellie start to express doubt in the park after the initial shock has worn off. Ian questions the ethical morality in cloning species that had not lived for thousands of years. Ellie expresses concern that the scientists may not be thinking about the repercussions that might occur of what they're cloning. And Alan continues to remain pretty neutral on the issue, though he advises John to be careful. Donald, the blood-sucking lawyer, is the only one that approves and thinks that the amount of money that they can make off the island is going to be massive.
And he suggests coupon day, too.
Coupon. If they can't afford it, coupons.
I'd love that about him. He's just so like, oh, coupons, whatever.
Couple bucks off. No big deal. And Hammond is pretty fired up at this point and says, I don't believe it. You're meant to come down here and defend me against these two characters. And the only one I have on my side is the blood-sucking lawyer.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong. This is when they have the Chilean sea bass?
Yes.
Okay,
that spared no expense.
Sounded like such a delicious lunch that
right.
The chef spared no expense to get this top of the line chef, and he makes this amazing lunch.
Mm-hmm.
Now I know I keep asking, I'm asking some weird questions here,
right?
But bear with me because this is one that I wondered as a kid because they're in this nice lunch room, they're eating Chilean,
yeah.
Expensive sea bass. As a kid, I don't want that. As a kid, I'm wondering, is there concession stands? Is it like Great America? Can I get a foot-long chili dog while I'm like puttering along in the Jeep?
Yeah, I'm thinking Tim is probably snacking on some chicken nuggets or something. There's no way he's eating Chilean sea bass.
Yeah.
And asparagus or whatever else they're giving him.
There's no way.
Yeah.
I always wondered that.
Good point. Yeah. Yeah, you gotta figure there's gotta be a McDonald's in there or something. They'll park that expensive. So after lunch, we start the tour of the park. So visitors are toured around in their electric tour vehicles. John's grandchildren, Lex and Tim, are gonna jump in and have taken a liking to Alan, who doesn't appreciate the attention or seem to like them whatsoever. On the tour, we see the goat that is getting released into the wild to basically be fed to the T-Rex. So one of my favorite things on Twitter is when I see the goat meme that pops up, or the GIF of the goat being lowered in there, usually before like a big boxing fight or MMA, which always cracks me up. The tour starts out pretty... pretty low key. We're not seeing a whole lot. And I know.
So this part's particularly cool because it takes Dr. Grant, who's an adult archaeologist, architect, paleontologist. I'm making fun of you.
Yeah. I caught it.
But he's got as much childlike wonder as Timmy and Alex.
Definitely, Lex. For sure.
And it's just so cool. Like, he's just dying to see the Dilophosaurus, the T-Rex, the what he already saw. What was the first dinosaur that they see?
The Dilophosaurus.
No, when they're out in the wild.
Oh, okay, okay.
Brachiosaurus?
Yes, Brachiosaurus and a herd of the Hadrosaurus.
There you go. So, I mean, he's just filled with childlike wonder and, you know, it's just, he's just dashed. His dreams are just destroyed. And I think that that's when, like, the facade of it all starts to really break for him, is that he realizes that this isn't Jurassic Park. This isn't a place where you go to see dinosaurs, but this is a zoo. Right. This is a place where dinosaurs are kept and captured and secreted away, and they're covered by trees, and, you know, we don't understand their behaviors, and that's all Alan Grant wants to do, and he can't do that.
Yeah. So his childlike wonder is going to kick in pretty heavy here, because they come up on a Triceratops who is under the weather, to say the least, with a mountain of shit about 12 feet high in the background. But Ellie gets out of the car, followed by Dr. Grant, followed by pretty much everybody else, and they have to pretty much stop the ride at that point, which is making Dr. Hammond pretty upset. And that's when he really starts in on Nedry here about the locks being programmed in like they had talked about. But let's talk about the Triceratops. This is probably the first time we get to see a dinosaur really up close. And Dr. Grant's like a kid in a candy store laying on his stomach and listening to him breathe. And we got dino droppings.
You're right. It's such a cool scene because it does then pay off to that wonderment that Alan Grant has.
Mm-hmm.
And we see Ellie Sattler. She jumps out of the vehicle and she just instantly gloves on. She's inspecting. Oh, okay. Well, this pisses me off. Right. The doctor that's there with the Triceratops.
Yes.
I mean, you just watched this movie this morning.
Right.
So there's a doctor, there's a veterinarian, whatever he is, he's inspecting the Triceratops.
Mm-hmm.
And here comes Ellie Sattler and she goes, did you check his, I forget, should you check his eyes or whatever?
Yeah, if his eyes are dilated. He goes, oh, no, I don't think they would be.
No, I didn't think about that.
And then, of course, they are 2 seconds later when she has a flashlight. You know.
Yes. So that part always pisses me off. Even as a kid, I was like, this guy's a scientist, he's a doctor, and he didn't think to check to see if the eyes were dilated?
Right.
Like, what was he doing that whole time? Was he... What, playing Game Boy? Like, what the fuck was he doing?
And then with basically the next breath, she immediately goes over to the poisonous plant that's there. And do you think he might have gotten into this? Oh, no, I don't think so on that either.
And, it's just so, just the worst. It was West Indian lilac. Oh, the dinosaurs know to stay away from that. I was like, how do you have a job? If I did that at my job and, you know, and I was writing something and marketing something, and I said, well, the customers know not to read when I wrote a bunch of swear words.
Right.
No. Worst.
Yeah, I didn't know that paleobotanists were experts in dino droppings, but apparently she just grabs the gloves and pushes the old dingbat out the way, and she's going she's going elbows deep in about a 8-foot pile of poop.
Yeah, she knows. I mean, I think that just goes to show just how smart or how educated or how committed she is, that she's willing to go through the shit to find out what she needs.
Right, absolutely. So now we start to kind of run into this tropical monsoon storm that just starts to hit the island. You see most of the employees start to leave, except for John, obviously the game warden. Muldoon, you still got Ray Arnold sticking around so he can get eaten. And so during the storm, this is when Dennis starts to shut down the security, except for the raptor fences. And as a result, the T-Rex breaks through the deactivated electric fence surrounding his pen and kills and eats an abandoned goat. And then he's going to go on and we get into the nice chase. Where he starts to track down the Jeeps. So let's dive into the first impressions of this giant T-Rex. And he's got some speed on him here.
Yeah, I mean, the first time that you really see the T-Rex just looming is definitely creepy, because I think you don't realize how big he is.
Right.
And, you know, he does eventually just put his big paw down on the Jeep and just, like, jam it into the mud. And it's just like, man, oh, man, like, when dinosaurs ruled the world, like, that's what John Hammond has brought back. And it's like, we don't stand a chance. It's like, they don't have any guns. They've got the flare. Their cars aren't quick enough to outrun it. He's the ultimate villain right now. The T-Rex is just...
Yep. So we obviously see the T-Rex, and he gets really close to the Jeep. At that point, the blood-sucking lawyer has seen enough, and he's going to run to take shelter, leaving the kids by themselves in the Jeep. Obviously, in a few minutes, he's going to see the T-Rex again while apparently taking a poop and reading a paper. But let's talk a little bit about... the lawyer and leaving the kids by themselves.
So I have to think that you have to put yourself in that position.
Right.
What would you do? I don't know. I don't know that I wouldn't have ran the same way that he did, but I can tell you I would not have tried to hide in the outhouse. Like, why would you hide in the bathroom? What's your best case scenario there?
Yeah, you got to just keep running.
Yeah.
I mean, you're Forrest Gump at that point. You're not stopping.
No. I mean, you're abandoning the kids. And he's got a good lead. I think I have to think that if he kept running, he would have made it back safely. But he stops and he hides.
Yep.
Dr. Ian Malcolm just said, you got to go, you got to go. Or is that Alan Grant that says that?
No, that's him. You got to go, you got to go. He's got all the best lines.
And, you know, I think I don't even know that they really ever acknowledge or care or worry about that he dies. So, like, does anybody ever say, like, hey, what happened to Gennaro? Or, like, oh, shit, Gennaro just died. I don't even think anyone cares.
I'm pretty sure they saw him in the mouth of the T-Rex being flung around back and forth. So I think they pretty much watched him get eaten.
Yeah, but then, you know, no one ever asked. Does John Hammond ever, like, hey, where's my lawyer?
Right. That's a good point. That's a good point. Probably one of the most underrated lines of the movie is as these alarms are going off in the control room, you hear Ray Arnold say, fences are failing all over the park. You go to John Hammond, he goes, fine, Nedry, check the vending machines.
Check the vending machines.
So that line killed me. And so the kids, you know, they're able to finally flee the wreckage. Ellie and Robert arrive. At first, they believe the only survivor of the attack is Ian, but upon further investigation, they find two sets of footprints. One is Alan's, and one belongs to the kids. Just then, the Tyrannosaurus returns, and Ian and Robert and Ellie barely escape her in the Jeep. Meanwhile, Dennis crashes his car, and while trying to winch it, he is going to meet his maker in the Dilophosaurus. So let's talk about Nedry getting killed, though. So he's on his way to try and meet the guy from InGen. And now, is that Dotson that he's trying to meet up with? Or is it it's like a ship captain, if I'm remembering right.
Yeah, I don't think it's actually Dotson. I think it's just a point person that he's going
He calls down to the boat, and the guy answers the phone and says he can't wait much longer.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when he goes into overdrive with packing up the can of shaving cream. So jumping into the Dilophosaurus here, so he goes face to face with Nedry here and starts to spit out a tar-like venom before he traps him inside the Jeep and kills him. And then that's when we see the canister fall down into the rocks and to never be spoke or heard of again.
So again, you know, I always go back to the losing of the glasses. To me, right. That's a big pivotal moment. He lost his glasses. He tries to throw. I love it when he's got the stick and he's like, get the stick, go fetch the stick. And he throws the stick like it's a dog.
Yeah.
And it doesn't work, but the Dilophosaurus is so playful. It's kind of like a fun scene that you almost think Nedry's not going to die. Like I was not expecting him to die. If I'm not mistaken, Dilophosauruses are carnivore, correct?
Correct.
But they're so small, and they're so, like, they got the do that. You do a great Dilophosaurus. Yeah, there it is.
Yeah.
You know, they're so playful and almost cute that, like, you know, you kind of think Nedry's going to get away from this and his master plan is going to come to fruition. And then, nope, he just gets eaten.
Yep. So in the process, the embryos are lost. And we catch back up with Al and Tim and Lex, who are going to spend a night in a tree. And it's pretty cool scenery there. I think that's when you finally start to see Dr. Grant warm up to the kids for the first time. And they are kind of sleeping on his shoulder there. And they're going to spend the night. And you can see some dinosaurs in the background, which is pretty cool. Next morning, they discover some hatched eggs, which means the dinosaurs are breeding, which was one of the concerns that they had. And Alan, Dr. Grant, is going to hypothesize that the frog DNA is responsible. Some species of frog are known to spontaneously change sex in a single sex environment. So I thought that was pretty... He's still 18. I love it. Back to that. So in the midst of them kind of waking up and discovering some things, we see Ray, and he's trying to hack Dennis's computer. Let's talk about the
So I'm surprised, like, Dennis Nedry has a pretty complex system going on, despite how messy his desk is.
Definitely a slob, for sure.
Yeah, he's a slob, and I think that the book goes a lot more into Nedry as a character and details and stuff like that. But It's fascinating that he's in the position. Again, I have to imagine the salaries at Jurassic Park are astronomical.
They're making some money for sure.
You know, and yet he has money problems. Yet he's fat. Yet he's overweight. He spends his time at the vending machine. He chugs diet soda, and he's just a slob.
Do we know for sure it's diet soda? I assume so. That makes sense, though.
To me, it makes sense. I think that if anyone ever asked...
Snicker bar and a diet soda, it makes it all better.
Yes. But he's extremely skilled and talented as an operator, as an architect of this computer system that he's created and that he's running and that he manipulates to steal the DNA.
Right.
And so it's kind of funny to see then him on the screen going, you didn't say the magic word. And, you know, Samuel L. Jackson, oh, please, damn it.
That's such a good impression.
Well, thank you. It creates a great juxtaposition between the characters that it's such a fun, memorable scene.
Right. Right. So ultimately, because he can't guess the magic word, he's going to have to do a full system restart, which is going to require the circuit breakers to manually reset from the utility shed here. This is the part where the raptors are going to get loose because the power lines are going to go down and those electric fences are no longer going to be any good against those raptors. So we can pretty much blame Nedry for this entire thing going wrong.
Yeah, it definitely does come down to it's Nedry's fault. So many people die because of Nedry.
Right.
And for what you said, $1.5 million?
Yeah.
It's greedy.
Million and a half. He's a greedy.
It's Michael Crichton made more money off of, like you were saying, for the proceeds from selling the screenplay and the book.
So at this point, they're going to have to manually reset the entire system. Ray's going to have to stay back because he's going to make sure the computers are back up and working. So it's basically Dr. Hammond or Ellie. And they've got Robert as well, who will be there to help get him to the right spot. So ultimately, Ellie convinces Hammond she's the right one to go. They're going to shut down and cut the power off of the electric fences. Robert realizes that the raptors are near and tells Ellie to go to the utility shed herself and turn the power back on, and while he tries to hunt the raptor.
I love that he decides to hunt the raptors.
Right.
He's such a cool kid. What, he's a big game warden or something?
Yes.
Like, I just imagine him in his youth in Africa, just like hunting lions by hand, laughing as like the villagers are scared. And he's like, ha ha ha. I just hunt these things.
Yeah, I love the accent is perfect for him. He's got definitely got a little bit of that. Who's the guy that was eaten by the or stung by the stingray and died?
Steve Irwin.
Oh yeah, he's definitely a little play on Steve Irwin.
For sure. Yeah, I like that.
So Ellie manages to turn the power back on, nearly escaping the raptor that was following her. She meets Alan. And they go back to Ian and John in the emergency bunkers. Lex and Tim narrowly escaped the big one, the female raptor in the kitchen. And the raptor set a trap for old Muldoon, and he is tackled and eaten by the big one. So let's talk about the end of Muldoon and getting set up by the big girl.
So I think it's interesting because, you know, he is trying to hunt them. He places his hat down on the log to try to distract them.
Right.
He sets up his gun. He's got his sights ready to go. And then whoosh, they get him.
Right.
And then they show as he's getting eaten, they close up on the one raptor's eye that's got the snake slithering by.
Yep.
So is that the female?
That's the female. That's the big one.
The female, and we got the snake, and they're out in the, it's like the Garden of Eden, man.
Yeah, absolutely.
He was betrayed by a female.
Now, with, we've got Ray back in the control room. Do we see Ray get killed?
No.
Okay. Because what I'm remembering is Ellie escapes another raptor, and then we see Ray's arm in the maintenance shed.
Yes.
And, after she outsmarts the raptor, locking one of them in the freezer and knocking the big one out for several minutes. Lex is finally able to restore the park's computer system in order to call John to request a helicopter rescue of the survivors.
It's almost like a zombie movie.
Pretty nice little turn of events there where she's get the power back on. We've got the helicopter coming. There may be a happy ending here.
There might be. I mean, so one of my favorite parts, and it's always been my favorite part, is when you find out that Mr. Arnold is dead, just to go back to the part in the maintenance shade. And she bumps into the fence, and then the arm just comes down and like rests on her shoulder. Mm-hmm. And she goes, "Oh, Mr. Arnold." And then she turns around and you realize the arm is detached. And that's the end of Samuel L. Jackson in Jurassic Park. He ends with just a limb.
Well, yeah, he went out on his shield for sure. I'm sure he went down with a fight.
I thought you were going to say he went out on a limb.
That's a nice pun. I like that. So at that point, we got Alan and Ellie hold off the big one. They're trying to keep the door shut to the computer room. Power is restored. The locks begin to work, and they're able to secure the door. The raptor's being a lot smarter than what they assumed, break into the room through the window. After Grant shoots at it through the glass, and the group climbs up into the ceiling crawl space and arrive at the visitor center with the big old skeleton. So we're kind of coming to the end here. We're to the visitor center. We got the giant T-Rex skeleton. Take us from there.
First of all, this part in the video game was so much fun and so scary.
About the classic NES or the Sega?
Sega. For me, it was Sega.
Nice.
So the chase scene was so intense that they're going through. Like, the raptors are so smart and they're so athletic and they're so just able to jump and they're running and they're clawing. And like the way that like you don't think that they stand a chance, the humans, of surviving, of winning, of anything.
What? Yeah, like, exactly.
You kind of think that like they're just going to be collateral damage, and they make their way out onto the skeleton. Or I think they come down from the ceiling onto the skeleton. Yeah,
exactly.
Right?
And then you've got the big one, the velociraptors jumping up trying to get them.
Yeah. Oh my gosh, that was so scary to see like how high that they could jump. Like seriously, they're athletic animals. Like,
oh, definitely.
In Jurassic World, when Vincent Furnario wants to turn them into like super soldiers, man, he's got the right idea.
Yes. Yep, absolutely.
So I can never say his name.
Which one?
Vince Dunfernaffernaffernaffernaffernaffernaffernaffernaffernaffernaffernaffernaffernaffernaffernaffernaffernaffernaffernaffernaffernaffernaffernaffernaffernaffernaffernaffernaffernaffernaffernaffernaffernaffernaffernaffernaffernaffernaffernaffernaffernaffernaffernaffernaffernaffernaffernaffernaffernaffernaffernaffernaffernaffernaffernaffernaffernaffernaffernaffernaffernaffernaffernaffernaffernaffernaffernaffernaffernaffernaffernaffernaffernaffernaffernaffernaffernaffernaffernaffernaffernaffernaffernaffernaffernaffernaffernaffernaffernaffernaffernaffernaffernaffernaffernaffernaffernaffernaffernaffernaffernaffernaffernaffernaffernaffernaffernaffernaffernaffernaffernaffernaffernaffernaffernaffernaffernaffernaffernaffernaffernaffernaffernaffernaffernaffernafferna
So Lex is, at that point, she's almost killed by the big one leaping in the air. The raptors pursue, and after a scuffle with the big one on top of the fossil exhibit, the raptors block the escape route. Help comes from an unlikely source, though. The hero makes his big entrance.
I don't know. I personally wasn't expecting it to see the T-Rex just come barreling. How he got inside the building, I don't know. Because
I'm trying to think back to 8-year-old me, and you see this big T-Rex, and he eats the blood-sucking lawyer. He hurts Dr. Malcolm and, you know, bloodies him up. And then all of a sudden, he's the hero.
Yeah. Which is I think, like, that's like the coolest part of it is when you think that it's about the humans, but it's like, no, it's about the dinosaurs, right? And it's about this T-Rex, and here he comes, and he gets his what's the word? He gets validation. Like, he's not a bad guy. He's just an animal.
Right. It definitely has a nice kind of correlation to King Kong. I don't know if you saw it. I just watched the latest one, which wasn't too bad. I thought it was pretty good, but, you know, he's originally, they think that he's the enemy, and it ends up he's the one that basically saves everybody, and he's
right.
He's protecting the island, which kind of feels like the T-Rex here. You know, the Velociraptors are, you know, they think that they're going to run the park, and the T-Rex definitely has other ideas here.
Yeah, he's definitely the king of Jurassic Park, and he's willing to, you know, look at who he thinks to be the next biggest threat. And to T-Rex, it's not the humans. To T-Rex, it's the Velociraptors, and he realizes that he needs to get them in check. I think T-Rex knows that humans can't do anything to him.
Mm-hmm. Yep, absolutely. So T-Rex comes in. He saves the day. Alan, Ellie, Lex, and Tim are going to make their escape through the exits that are no longer being blocked. And it just so happens that Dr. Hammond and Ian are just pulling up right as they come out the doors. Perfect timing. And they've got the Jeep ready, and they leave. Cool line at the end of the movie here. Alan goes up as right before he's getting into the Jeep and says, "Dr. Hammond, after careful consideration, I've decided not to endorse your park." And then kind of subtly, John Hammond says, "So have I." And they drive off, and next thing you know, they're in the helicopter and they're leaving the island. That's essentially the end of the movie here. But I thought that was a cool way to end it, even though I'm not sure I would have stopped for a conversation before getting in the Jeep, knowing that my life was on the line. But hindsight being 2020, they get out of there pretty much intact, which is good. Thoughts on the ending?
I'm going to give you a serious thought and then a silly thought.
Okay.
The serious thought is the way that everything comes clean, and they make it out and they escape, and John Hammond realizes the fault. You know, right. He's sort of just like, yeah, like that did not turn out well. Which, you know, it's not all his fault. Nedry played a huge part in it. It's unfortunate that, you know, we never got to see Coupon Day.
No Coupon Day until maybe Jurassic World. They might, I want to rewatch that now and see if there's any mention of coupons.
That's a good point.
Let's see if they made the tie in there.
So then the silly point that I want to make is I've always wondered this, and I may have said this to you before, but I want there to be a sequel to Jurassic Park that is just an episode of like L.A. Law, where the whole sequel is John Hammond on trial for the murder of all of these people. Somebody has to answer. A lot of people are dead.
Right.
And he's responsible for it. He's going to get sued, and he's going to get sued hard, and he's going to wind up in prison. And I want to see an episode of L.A. Law where that is it. That's the court case.
I love it. So, unfortunately, a sequel doesn't come for quite a while, as they milk the theater and then the VHS sales for about 2 or 3 years. We don't see a sequel for Jurassic Park until 1997. I don't know when we're going to eventually talk about The Lost World, but just, I guess, your initial thoughts on The Lost World and the long-awaited sequel 4 years later.
I didn't see Lost World in theaters. I will admit it.
So you weren't sold, and now you're 12 years old. You're not sold on this sequel. You're not ponying up $6.
No, I'm not doing it. And I don't know what it was about it that just didn't really grab me. It just seemed to, like, it seemed like it didn't understand the point of Jurassic Park.
Sure.
And I think the third one as well didn't understand the point of Jurassic Park. Mm-hmm. Which is what I worry will happen with the new sequel to Jurassic World. Like, I think Jurassic World understood the point of Jurassic Park.
100% agreed.
But I worry, like, without the park, without the entertainment aspect of it, without the tension that comes from that, like, you know, any of those movies could have gone right to the Sci-Fi Channel.
That's an interesting take. I was a big fan of The Lost World, and we're going to cover that on a future episode of Back in Time podcast. But I can hear the music in the background, and that's going to be our go-home cue for today. Thank you for listening to the very first episode of the Back in Time podcast. We will be back next week, Monday, to discuss the 1989 film, one of my personal favorites, Batman. Remember to subscribe on iTunes. It's very simple. You click the subscribe button next to the name of the podcast every Monday. The podcast will be downloaded directly to your device. It's super easy. It helps us in the process grow this thing. Leave us a review on iTunes. Give us a 5-star review. Leave us a comment in there. Let people know if you enjoy the podcast. You can find us on YouTube and social media at Back in Time Pod. For JD and myself, it's been a pleasure, and we will talk to you next week.
I need a nuclear reaction to generate 1.21 gigawatts of electricity. What did I just say? This fucker's electric. But I need a nuclear reaction to generate the 1.21 gigawatts of electricity.
1.21 gigawatts!